The EU looks to sanction some Israeli government ministers.
Launching hate messages, unacceptable hate messages against the Palestinians, and proposing things that goes clearly against international law.
Plus, we hear from a journalist freed from wrongful detention in Russia.
I was greeted by the president and by vice president, and it was such an honor for me, but everything I could see was my daughters.
And later, corruption in Sudan, an update from Kyiv, and increasing pressure on the U.S. to do more to protect human rights in Afghanistan. Today is Thursday, August 29th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint.
Good evening, I'm Lori London, along with Steve Karish. The Israeli military says it killed a top Islamic Jihad group commander early Thursday in the West Bank as it pressed ahead with a large-scale operation it launched this week. Violence has surged in the West Bank since Hamas's October 7th attack inside southern Israel ignited the war.
It is time for the slaughter to end.
As the death toll mounts in Gaza and the West Bank, Ireland's foreign minister Michel Martin, at a meeting of EU foreign ministers Thursday, accused Israel of deliberately targeting civilians as well as Hamas militants.
It's very clear to us that this is essentially a war against Palestinians, not just against Hamas. The level of civilian casualties and death is unconscionable. The starvation, we now have polio within Gaza, it's quite shocking, and it needs to stop. And we need an immediate release of all hostages, and we need unimpeded access to humanitarian aid.
Ireland and the European Union's top diplomat Josep Borrell are urging the bloc to review its relations with Israel and to impose sanctions against some government ministers.
Including in our list of sanctions, some Israeli ministers has been launching hate messages, unacceptable hate messages against the Palestinians, and proposing things that goes clearly against international law and is an incitation to commit war crimes.
A UN human rights spokesperson said this latest operation in the West Bank risks seriously deepening an already catastrophic situation.
And in Europe, more Russian attacks across Ukraine, and the Netherlands has changed course and will allow Ukraine to use the F-16s it's given Kyiv to go into Russian territory with no restrictions. VOA's Anna Chernikova reports from Kyiv.
On August 29th, Ukraine marks the Day of Remembrance of the Defenders of Ukraine, who died in the struggle for independence, sovereignty, and territorial integrity of the country. The day marks the anniversary of the Ilovaisk tragedy, when on August 29th, 2014, Russian forces killed 366 Ukrainian soldiers and injured 429 while Ukrainian troops were withdrawing from their positions through the pre-agreed humanitarian corridor.
Сьогодні день, коли Україна особливо вшановує пам'ять усіх наших полеглих.
President Zelensky says it's a day to honor the memory of the fallen soldiers and to be grateful for the sacrifices they made. 10 years later, on this day, Russian forces launched another massive drone and missile attack across Ukraine, the third this week. The regions affected are the Kharkiv, Cherkasy, Kirovohrad, Kyiv, Poltava, Dnipropetrovsk, Kherson, Sumy, and Donetsk regions. A series of explosions were heard in the capital Kyiv during the night. Local authorities reported that 15 drones were targeting Kyiv, and all of them were destroyed. The air raid alert lasted for 6 hours. The energy infrastructure was the main target once again. No casualties been reported. Meanwhile, Minister of Foreign Affairs of Ukraine, Dmytro Kuleba, is in Brussels to attend a meeting of the heads of foreign affairs of the European Union states. When addressing the question from Radio Liberty journalists, Kuleba said that Ukraine calls on the EU to play an important role in the discussion and providing Ukraine with the permission to use weapons provided by the Allies, to hit targets on the territory of Russia for defense purposes.
Ми очікуємо на дозвіл, саме так, очікуємо також на...
Obtaining permission to strike deeper into Russian territory with weapons provided by Western allies is a top priority for Ukraine in these talks, and there is some early success. Onno Ehelsheim, the general of the Royal Netherlands Air Force, says that Kyiv can use the F-16 fighter jets provided to Ukraine by his country for strikes anywhere on Russian territory. He said that there are no restrictions on the use and flight range of the F-16s. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan met with Chinese President Xi Jinping in Beijing on Thursday, wrapping up 3 days of wide-ranging talks aimed at easing tensions between the two world powers ahead of November's U.S. elections. As the pair sat down in the Great Hall of the People, Xi told Sullivan that Beijing was committed to a stable relationship with Washington. She said that in this changing and turbulent world, countries need solidarity and coordination instead of division or confrontation. The people want openness and progress, not exclusion or regress. Sullivan told Xi that President Joe Biden was committed to managing the relationship to avoid conflict.
President Biden is committed to responsibly managing this consequential relationship, to ensure that competition does not veer into conflict or confrontation, and to work together where our interests align. We are committed to maintaining high-level diplomacy, and to this end, President Biden looks forward to engaging with you again in the coming weeks.
This week's discussions covered a range of issues that have been complicating ties between the countries, including tensions over Taiwan, the South China Sea, and Russia, as well as U.S. demands for more Chinese help to stem the flow of the raw ingredients for fentanyl into the United States.
On August 1st, a historic prisoner swap freed three Americans imprisoned in Russia, including two journalists. VOA had a chance to speak with one of those American journalists released in the exchange. Joining us now is VOA Press Freedom editor Jessica Jarit, whose team has been working to shine a light on the journalists risking their lives to bring truth and information that's often repressed in places across the globe.
It just seems like every day we're hearing another story about another journalist either being jailed or being killed. And of course, this week alone, we've got protests in Iraq over a drone strike that killed two journalists. We've got the junta in Myanmar that have killed two journalists. And also this week, a member of the Reuters news agency killed when a missile hit the hotel where he was staying. It just seems like journalists across the world are really now in life-threatening situations more than ever.
Yes, Lori, that's certainly the case. I think journalism has never been as dangerous a profession as it is today. Some of the cases you mentioned, I think, really tie in with a lot of conflicts that are happening right now. In Myanmar, where they've had civil war since the coup in 2021, media have come under fire right from the start, mostly with jailings. But in this case, two journalists who were reporting on the resistance movement were killed when 30 armed men raided their home. They were speaking to two resistance fighters at the time, four people killed. And the case that you mentioned Saturday in eastern Ukraine, Ryan Evans, who's a safety advisor with Reuters, was sadly killed when there was a Russian strike on a hotel known as a base for aid workers and journalists. Ryan was there as part of a six-member media crew. Two other Reuters journalists are seriously injured and being treated for their injuries. This kind of targeting just really, it makes it even harder at a time when we need our journalists on the front line to explain what's happening with these conflicts and the toll to civilians. We are becoming more and more targeted and putting our lives at risk, and it's a real sad state and a loss, I think, for the whole journalism community when we have these cases.
And we had at least a good news story recently with the release of several American journalists, among others, from Russia in the prisoner exchange. One of them was American-Russian journalist Alsu Kermisheva. And VOA Press Freedom team had a chance to speak with her and talk about how she's adjusting to life here. How did this come about? And this wasn't just talking about her release and the excitement of that. This is something that the team has been heavily engaged in for quite a while, is this issue.
Yes, and as you say, I mean, it is a rare good news day for press freedom, the historic prisoner swap. I think what's sort of unique about this case is at VOA we have a press freedom desk, so we cover these issues all the time. So we're not just there for the case of a journalist being arrested or released. While we cover those, we cover everything in between. And particularly with Alsu Kermisheva and the Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich, we've worked very closely with their friends, with their colleagues, the people involved in this immense campaign to try to secure this historic release. And it's really opened up our eyes to the burden that are placed on families when an American is taken hostage. And we see authoritarian governments do that more and more. But just the resolve and the community that comes around to support people during this time and to keep reminding the world that Alsu and Evan were jailed for nothing more than being a journalist and for being Americans. It's been a very sort of powerful story to tell. It's been on a personal level for the whole team, just getting to know Alsu's family. She has two young daughters, Bibi and Miriam, who have been out and very vocal speaking out about their mother's case in the past year. And it's just been to see that moment. We were there on the tarmac when they landed, and it was just this overwhelming moment of seeing all of the good that journalism can do in reporting, in explaining these issues, explaining how Russians are using hostage taking as a tactic, and to see that the power of advocacy and US foreign policy can bring our Americans safely home.
VOA Press Freedom Editor Jessica Jarid. And as Jessica mentioned, while in Washington this week to receive an award, newly freed Radio Free Europe journalist Alsu Kermisheva sat down with VOA and tells our colleague Liam Scott that the fate of other political prisoners is on her mind.
It's the moment Alsu Kermisheva had dreamed of for months. An emotional reunion with her family at Joint Base Andrews outside Washington after more than 9 months of wrongful detention in Russia.
I was greeted by the president and my vice president, and it was such an honor for me. But everything I could see was my daughters.
A journalist for VOA sister outlet Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty in Prague, Kermisheva was convicted in a secret trial on charges of spreading false information about the Russian military.
I was jailed for 288 days, and every minute of it is suffering. It's going through humiliation, and inmates in Russia and Belarus, they don't have any rights.
Freed as part of a historic prisoner swap on August 1st, Kermisheva traveled first to a military base in Texas and then to her home in Prague to recover.
I want to enjoy my life from now on.
Back in Prague, finally setting foot in her family's apartment was overwhelming, she said.
I cried. I cried for the first time since many days. I knew I would cry because it meant a lot. It was such a happy cry. I still can't stop hugging my children.
Kermisheva's case is part of Moscow's wider crackdown on independent media. She was one of two American journalists the United States says were wrongfully detained in Russia. Like Kermisheva, Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich was detained and convicted in a sham trial before also being released in the swap. Learning that Gershkovich would walk free was emotional for Paul Beckett, who led the journal's campaign to secure the reporter's release.
Tears of relief, smiles of joy. Hard to fully comprehend. I think it's probably still a bit hard to fully comprehend, but yeah, just a moment of an enormous weight lifted, and all of the effort felt like at that moment it paid off.
Gershkovich is doing well, despite having spent around 500 days in prison, Beckett says.
It's just amazing to get a life started, restarted. So that's what we've been focused on. I think he's taking time to decompress and just find his feet again.
The cases of Gershkovich and Kermisheva highlight the Russian government's harsh crackdown on independent journalism.
And journalists are afraid to seek independent sources of information because all those sources have been banned or have been designated illegal in Russia. The whole society and also media has been put on survival mode.
Now reunited with her family, Kermisheva says she wants to turn her attention to political prisoners still jailed, including three of her colleagues at RFERL. Liam Scott, VOA News.
You're listening to Flashpoint from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish with Lori London in Washington. As Sudan faces a humanitarian crisis, the World Food Program is facing allegations of corruption there. That story coming up. Now, though, 3 years of Taliban rule in Afghanistan has brought misery upon the country's girls and women, say critics of the hardline regime. Both President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris this week marked the third anniversary of the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, but advocates want to see Washington do more to help, to push harder against the egregious human rights situation. VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell reports from Washington.
The Taliban want this to be the picture of their 3 years of rule in Afghanistan. But this is a realer picture. Parwana Malik was sold into marriage shortly after American forces withdrew 3 years ago this week. She was 9 years old. She is not an exception. Local media has reported on girls as young as 7 or 8 being married off to Taliban officials. Parwana was photographed for the nonprofit Too Young to Wed. Stephanie Sinclair is its founder.
What the Taliban is doing to women and girls is absolutely a crime against humanity. And Afghan girls and women inside the country are really suffering.
President Joe Biden issued a statement on the anniversary honoring the service members who died during the withdrawal and defending the pullout. Vice President Kamala Harris issued a similar statement. Like Biden, she did not mention girls and women, though as a lawyer seeking her nation's top job, she is a living repudiation of the Taliban's edict that girls cannot be schooled past sixth grade. Republican presidential challenger Donald Trump also focused on the deaths of 13 American service members in criticizing the Biden administration's pullout.
Caused by Kamala Harris, Joe Biden, the humiliation in Afghanistan set off the collapse of American credibility and respect all around the world.
Earlier this month, at an event marking the anniversary, this Taliban official gave a defiant speech criticizing foreign interference. Women, including journalists, were barred from the event. The regime recently passed a law restricting women's movements and requiring them to cover their bodies and silence their voices in public. The United Nations called the law egregious and demanded its repeal. The exiled leader of Afghanistan's top resistance movement argues that trampling the human rights of half the population is bad policy and bad politics. Ahmed Massoud heads the National Resistance Front of Afghanistan.
They do not represent the will of the population. Afghanistan's youth, especially young girls, have dreams and aspiration no different from their peers around the globe.
On this anniversary, photographer Sinclair urged American leaders to focus not on the men in charge, but on the voices they have silenced, and to impose harsher consequences for it. And now, a plot twist. Too Young to Wed persuaded Parwana's elderly husband to return her to her family. She's back where she belongs, Sinclair says. In school.
She's quite the character. She has a lot of, you know, big opinions, and she wants to be a teacher or a doctor. You know, she wants to do something, and she's got the power to do it. The problem is she's not living in a society that is permitting it.
But as she nears the sixth grade, she carries a burden of knowing that unless something changes, her time is running short. Anita Powell, VOA News, Washington.
In war-torn Sudan, there is already a humanitarian crisis, and now the UN World Food Program is investigating two of its top officials there, the very people who are supposed to be helping over allegations of corruption. Reuters' Freddie Joyner has more.
As the United Nations World Food Program struggles to feed millions of people in war-torn Sudan, the humanitarian organization has now launched an investigation into two of its top officials in the country over allegations of fraud and concealing information from donors about its ability to deliver food aid to civilians. That's according to 11 people with knowledge of the investigation. Five of the sources who spoke to Reuters say investigators are looking at whether WFP staff sought to hide the alleged role of Sudan's army in obstructing aid amid a brutal 16-month war with a rival paramilitary for control of the country. One of the officials being investigated has since been given a temporary duty assignment outside Sudan, while Reuters could not confirm the current role of the other. When asked about the probe, the WFP said, "Allegations of individual misconduct related to irregularities in pockets of our operation in Sudan are under urgent review by its Inspector General's office. Meanwhile, the U.S. government's aid agency, USAID, the single largest donor to the WFP, said the allegations were deeply concerning and must be thoroughly investigated. Battling severe hunger on many fronts, the World Food Program is currently seeking close to $23 billion in funding to feed millions of people. That includes more than a million on the brink of famine, mostly in Sudan and Gaza.
That's Reuters' Freddie Joyner reporting for us today.
Food is an issue in Japan, too. After extreme weather ravaged last year's rice crop, Japan is hoping new heat-resistant varieties of its staple food can help stave disaster in the future. Gabe Singer of Reuters brings us this story.
After extreme weather ravaged Japan's rice harvest last year, the country is grappling with a stark shortage of a food that many see as a crucial staple there. Supermarkets across the country have struggled to keep rice on the shelves in recent months, and some have even imposed quotas on how much customers can buy. With reserves of the grain at their lowest in a quarter century and temperatures still on the rise, Japan is turning to science to prevent future supply shocks and is on a mission to develop more heat-resistant strains of rice. Saitama Prefecture, north of Tokyo, is one of the hottest regions in the country. The local government here is pushing ahead with one of several nationwide projects to develop more resilient rice. Saitama's Agricultural Technology Research Center is experimenting with a heat-resistant variety called Emihokoro, which translates to beaming smile. Researchers here cultivate and cross-pollinate seeds from across Japan to create hardier varieties like Emihokoro, which has been planted in dozens of fields as part of a trial. Naoto Ooka oversees the operation.
As there hasn't been anything resistant to heat before now, we cultivated this with the aim of having high temperature resistance and being a little slower growing than the previous crop.
High heat disrupts the accumulation of starch inside rice grains, causing them to appear more opaque, mottled with white flecks, and less desirable for humans to eat. Ooka hopes to eventually breed resilient varieties together to reach new heights of heat resistance.
As our understanding continues to progress, I think an important future task for us will be to make further improvements on the current level by combining varieties with high heat tolerances.
The world's fourth largest economy imports more than 60% of its food resources, but rice is also one of the few things the nation has historically been able to produce self-sustainably. Last year's poor yields have contributed to dwindling stocks and soaring prices this summer. And an agriculture ministry report released in July gave more cause for concern, projecting rice paddy yields in Japan to decline about 20% by 2100 compared to the previous century. The ministry said shifting to high-temperature-tolerant rice varieties like Emihokoro was Japan's most important measure to address the impact of climate change on crops and possible future shortages. Yoshitaka Funakawa is a 73-year-old farmer who is participating in the Saitama trial run. Like the government officials in Tokyo, he is also betting on science.
It's going to keep getting hotter, which makes me feel that without varieties that resist high temperatures, this is going to become a very tough job.
That's Gabe Singer of Reuters reporting.
Also in Japan, more than 5 million people have been told to evacuate from their homes as Typhoon Shanshan lashed the country's southwest on Thursday. The storm is expected to approach Tokyo around the weekend, according to the country's weather agency. And that does it for today's program, but there is more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of Steve Karish and all of us here at VOA, thank you so much for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Lori London.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with a 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.